Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
So at this point, we usually go around and say our names, and maybe one sentence about something you've done around Mother's Day, or something to do with mothering. So my name's Bob, and let's see, yesterday I spent with my three children, and their two mothers, and I gave them all cards, and they gave me
practices. My name is Scott. I'm in denial about Mother's Day.
My name is Jim, and I just came back from communing with Mother Nature, camping, and watching the whales frolic just off the coast. It was extremely lovely, and I have to call my mother and tell her about it.
My name is Carl, and though I have not spoken with my mother in quite some time, I do plan on calling her and speaking to her because I feel great compassion for her.
My name is Snake, and I believe my mother is probably walking the golden streets of heaven, as she always dreamed of. We have a good relationship.
My name is Fred, and I must be very honest with you, I've forgotten about being Mother's Day. My mother's been gone for some time, and it just passed me.
I'm Robert. I was home in New York last weekend, and I took my mom to the garden center and bought her favorite flower, and a potted gardenia. This is fertilizer.
I'm Randy. I spoke to my mother this morning, and about this time, she's probably gathering roses at her mother's.
I'm Bill. I'm Mother's Day. I'm looking at roses.
I'm Paul, and I've never met his ex-mother.
My name is Jim, and I talked to my mom yesterday, so I could hopefully a good book, and I wish you both a better son.
Peter, I might call my mother later.
I'm Peter, and do mother-in-laws count? We'll be doing something with her.
I'm John. I sent my mother a card and we'll call her.
My name is Bob. I think sometime during the past year, I talked about the fact that since my mother's been gone for several years, that I don't. Try to find an appropriate Mother's Day card.
grateful for my 100 flowers bad house. I took care of everything for
me. I'm Mike, and I think Connor will look at my mother later.
And I'm Roger, and my mother of this incarnation has been dead for many years, and I have lived in America long enough to realize that this is Mother's Day and not the one in the middle of Lent, which is the one I got used to in England. And for Mother's Day, I'm going to be speaking of the motherly aspects of the Dharma, I hope.
So what is our speaker? He's Professor of Religion Emeritus at Duke University and retired to the Bay Area. He contributes to the GBF newsletter under the name of Dharma Daddy. And he's the author of several books. I Am Food, about the Catholic Mass, was just reprinted. I think he has a copy of something else. And Visions of Buddhism is another one of his books, and we have a discussion group on the second Wednesday of the month at my place. If you want more information, let me know.
Which is this Wednesday. I might as well take the time now then to just briefly talk about this. This has been out of print for some time. One of the first books that I wrote, it's quite a short book, as you see. I don't think long books are too much to read and to write. If you are brought up in the Christian tradition and have come to Buddhism because of problems, you may prefer to have your fingernails ripped out with red-hot pincers rather than go back to the Christian tradition. But this book might give you some kind of idea of the richness of the tradition. It is a series of meditations on the Mass, as practiced in the Roman Catholic tradition and others that are similar to that, such as Episcopalian and some of the Lutherans. But it uses insights from the Buddhist tradition. Particularly, it is structured around entry into the Tibetan mandala. So it'll be different. It won't be something. And this was in the days I used to write poetry. It's not too bad, actually. I mean, I stopped writing poetry after a bit. I got sort of mature. I found I wrote poetry when I wasn't sure of myself. But it isn't bad, really. I mean, some of this poetry is not. So you can have a look at that later. And it's published by a reprint society who does short runs. So it's not available in bookstores yet. I'm going to try to get some of the Bay Area places to order it, but it can be ordered online, and you get a discount if you order it online. And it's only about $10, I think, online. So, and then for all of you Jubus, maybe some in the room now, if you liked my vision of Buddhism, and many people do, although they don't seem to be able to have time to come to the class on it, that is the first book in a planned series. And each of these books is a different approach to the tradition, and it takes a long time to get someone to write it and come up with a nice way of doing it, rather than doing everything the same. And we come up with a controlling metaphor for each. So up to now, up until recently, only two books were out, Vision of Buddhism and Vision of Islam. Vision of Islam is doing rather well now, as you might imagine, if people want to have some idea of what's really going on with Islam, not just terrorism. And Vision of Judaism is just out. The controlling metaphor of this is wrestling with God and with the tradition and so forth, and that's why there's a picture of Jacob wrestling with the angel on the front. It's written by a Reform rabbi who lives in Wales, actually, and he gives a fair explanation of his, he talks about his experience with Reform Judaism, a good, fair explanation of the history of a topic, and then his suggestions as to how to change things, so as he is wrestling with the tradition. It's a controversial book, and at first I was a bit nervous of a controversial book, but then I thought, How can you have a book that's written by a Jew that Jews can relate to if it isn't controversial? You've got to have arguments. So I think it's very good. So I will leave this copy out. I'll give a couple of flyers out too. Take a flyer if you like. If you really want to have the book, you can have it for half price. Otherwise, just have a look at it and then order later. All right, that's the end of the commercial. And now back to our regularly scheduled program. I want to try to help us to reflect on the notion of mother and motherliness, since I have realized over the years that I am not alone in having had problems with my mother. It seems that all gay men come from a dysfunctional family in which the mother was controlling. There are exceptions to this, but they seem to be rather rare. And so I had a very negative attitude towards my mother. We used to argue a lot. We didn't physically fight. I tried to physically fight her once, and I was quite little at the time, and I went up and hit her on the breast, and my father said, "Don't you ever do that again. Your mother will get breast cancer and have to be cut off." So so then I resorted to intellectual I usually won, actually, because she was certainly bright, but she had a lot of other things to do, like the kitchen, and couldn't bother to argue. So I've had to come around to look at that and try to find some other approach to it rather than just having a fight. And so I thought it would be helpful for me to talk about that this morning, and maybe it would be helpful to you also. When I thought about this, I thought, well, there's not very much to say. And then as I thought more, I said, well, there's a great deal to say, so I'll try to get somewhere in the middle. I imagine one should start with the mother of the Buddha, or the mother of the historical Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni, who I prefer to call the Buddha for our continuum rather than the historical Buddha. History, or the historical critical approach, is an approach to reality which itself is undefinable. Reality is undefinable. It's too much. I mean, part of it, we can't define it. But we can approach it through history, and we get certain things out of it when we do that. And one of the things we get out of it is a chap living in the northern Indian subcontinent around the 6th century BCE, before the Common Era. When we take a more Buddhist approach to reality, we find all kinds of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and whatever in different universes and different times, and we even talk of the Buddhas of the future, the past, present, and the future. And that's another approach to undefinable reality, which I think is equally valid. And I have argued when I was a full-time academic that our academic approach to Buddhism is not really academic. It is simplistic, because we only take the historical critical viewpoint as the worthwhile one. So that is why I call the Buddha Shakyamuni the Buddha for our continuum, because most of us live in a Cartesian, Newtonian type of universe. Even if we read about quantum physics and so forth, we don't really live in that. So that's a good place to start. And I'll try to expand from there, I think. So it is said that that the lady who was picked to be the mother of the Buddha, and all traditions of Buddhism, whether Theravada or Mahayana, Vajrayana, seem to take it for granted that the entity that was to be reborn as the Buddha for our era, for our continuum, was sufficiently self-conscious, that's to say not conscious of the self, but sufficiently aware that he was able to choose his time and place of rebirth so that he could make the final assault, as it were, on to enlightenment and liberation, so as to become the teacher of deities and humans for this era, and allow all deities, humans, and other beings to move towards liberation. So there must have been something special about his mother. We're not told a great deal about what it was, but he picked her out of all other women that might have been at that time. And the story is that when she conceived, she had a dream of a white elephant with six tusks that entered into her womb. The elephant is the royal animal. A white elephant is very rare, very precious, and the tusks are ivory, of course, they are very rich, a symbol of richness. So it is a symbol of something very extraordinary happening in her womb. Most of the accounts of the Buddha have him being conceived in the ordinary human way. So this is not an indication of a virgin birth, but an indication that she has conceived somebody extraordinary. There are some accounts of a virgin birth. I thought there were none at first, but I should have learned my lesson now. Whenever I say so-and-so is never the case in Buddhism, I then find out something when it is the case. So occasionally one does get some stories of a virgin birth, but they're not the most frequent. So the entity that was to be reborn from her was going to be either a world emperor or a Buddha, and it's not my topic today to talk of that, so we just all know the story that he became a Buddha. Whatever was special about her had then apparently to be preserved, because it is a tradition that after a woman gives birth to a future Buddha, she dies within a week. The tradition is that she went into the king and told him that she was taking a vow to be celibate until the time that she would die. And I guess he wasn't so upset because, you know, he was a king in those days. He had lots of other women around in the harem, as we call it now, but so he didn't sort of lose anything, but he lost her, I suppose. The one tradition is that when she died on Earth, then her womb was taken out from her and born by the deities into one of the heavens, where it was set up to be worshipped. Believe it or not. The importance then of the mother of the Buddha really it's an example of the ambiguous status, I think, of mothers and sex in the Buddhist tradition. She was merely seen to be the instrument of an important son. It's still today in a lot of cultures thought to be a disaster if a woman gives birth to a girl, and in some cultures it is still the case that the girl is allowed to die. And there's some problem in some parts of the world now where there aren't enough women to go around with the men, so whether they all turn gay, I don't know. But the Buddha is reported to have said that he said one should rejoice even at the birth of a girl, which was an advance on what was being said. However, he said, because that she might grow up to be a woman who will give birth to a noble son. So he was a little bit advanced in ahead of his time, but maybe he couldn't be any further than that. I mean, some cultures, it is still. I mean, we're hearing a lot about this in the news today. In some cultures, the woman is really not regarded as a full human being. She is regarded as the possession of the man. And so any kind of indication we have in the Buddhist tradition that the Buddha was trying to change this is remarkable, because this was 2,500 years ago or more. So there isn't a great deal to be said about actual physical mothers, I think, in Buddhism, except to note that the normal attitude towards a mother is recommended to be gratitude. It's difficult to be grateful to our mothers if all we can remember about her is that she was somehow mean to us in some way. And my mother was very critical of what I did. And if I stop on that, I can't get any further, and I just sort of get locked into anger and resentment. But it was opened up for me a bit when this came up as a discussion in a teaching with a Tibetan. And when someone was complaining about his or her mother, he said, but did she throw you away, or did she feed you and keep you? And, well, obviously, she kept me and she fed me. And, of course, looked after me for the 9 months I was in her womb. And that, since I've not been reborn as a woman in this life, I'm not quite sure what it would be like, but I must have been a woman sometime before. And it's a very strange thing, I think, to have this really strange thing happen to one's body, to go on for 9 months, and then to have an extraordinarily painful and rather frightening, if it's the first time, event to happen, especially, I think, in my mother's case. She was she gave birth to me at a time when nurses and doctors felt the best thing for patients that were making a fuss was to leave them alone, so that they would get themselves together. And she was left alone, I think, for most of the time that she gave birth to me. A similar thing happened apparently to me when I was little. I was for the first few weeks of my life, I was constantly crying, and they thought, oh, well, he's just wanting attention, so we leave him alone. Then they found I had a hernia. So then they had to find someone who could fix it, and in those days, that was 1938, that wasn't easy to find. So I think we need to reflect on that, maybe our mothers were mean to us in some way or another, but maybe that was because they were afraid that we were going to hurt ourselves in some way. They probably were trying to find the best thing for us, and they just didn't have the skills, maybe, to do it in the way that the Buddha might have done. If our mother didn't happen to be a Buddha, or the mother of the Buddha, maybe she wasn't quite as skilled as that. And as Carl said, we can have compassion for her, because probably she did the best she could, and she did go through a lot of grief to produce us. And if she hadn't have done that, we wouldn't even be here to complain about her. So I think we need to try to balance this out. At least I know I need to do that, and maybe some of you would feel the same way. So then going to other entities in the Buddhist tradition, there are a number of female entities who have a motherly aspect to them. I suppose the best known of all probably still is the Chinese and Japanese version of the Bodhisattva of compassion. Tends to be sold in gift shops as the Chinese goddess of mercy. In a sense, she is a kind of goddess of mercy. Officially, she's not actually a goddess, but ordinary Buddhists are typically a little vague on the distinction between Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and gods. They're all kind of these high beings that help us in some way. Bodhisattva who listens to the cries of the world, called in Japanese Kannon or Kanzeon, the Chinese, normally is reduced to Guanyin, meaning just the one who hears the cries of the world is understood. That's the third character, which is often omitted. And there are variations of that in Korean and Vietnamese. She is known all over East Asia. Actually, she is more common, I suppose, now in East Asia than he, though the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara could be a patron of all transgendered people because he becomes a she and doesn't really give up the he. I mean, you find both male and female versions. The idea is that the Bodhisattva of compassion takes on any form that is most helpful to people. And it so happens that in the Tibetan tradition, he is always regarded as a he, and is regarded as, I think, at 16 years old or sometimes 13. What they try to say when they say this entity is visualized as a woman or man of 13 or 16, they mean somebody in the prime of life, just as they're coming to flower in puberty and the hormones are raging, so they have this energy, this great energy. It's not supposed to be too sexual. You know, some parts of the tantra will get into that, but the idea is that you see somebody, somebody in that age, they have a lot of energy. I think we did too when we were young. Yes, so a very powerful figure, not liable to be tired by the work. And one tradition is that the Bodhisattva, who is the he or she is the manifestation of the compassionate aspect of the mind. The compassion aspect, of course, is compassionate for all living beings, and so he looked around at all living beings and wasn't able to look in all directions at once, and tried to do this so quickly that his head split into 11. And so one of the forms of the Bodhisattva, he has 11 different heads and 1,000 arms, because trying to help all beings all around. Feeds back into a quite early tradition found in the Pali texts that the Buddha is compassionate towards all living beings, not just to humans, and certainly not just to the ones that he likes, is compassionate in the way that a mother has concern or is compassionate for her only child. The image here, I think, is that the compassion of a mother for her only child is what we call an instinct, a biological instinct, and it is a symbol or metaphor for how the Buddha mind relates in its compassion aspect to all living beings. That is to say, it does so automatically. If a mother of an only child sees the child wandering off into the middle of the street and there's cars coming by, she doesn't observe this and then start to consider within herself, I think the child is going into danger. What would be the best thing to do in this case? Would it be good to run after it and pick it up? Or what should I do? There's no time for that. The woman sees the child, rushes out and brings it back. It's automatic. It happens without thinking. And although that is a biological instinct, we say, the mind of the Buddha mind is functioning in the same kind of automatic kind of way. This automatic functioning is called by the Tibetans hlundup, meaning it spontaneously happens. It you don't think first. It's also called the thoughtless mode, or without thought in the East Asian tradition. Doesn't mean that you have become a zombie, but that your Buddha mind is automatically taking over, and you don't have to think the thing through first, because there's no time for that. And also that would mean that if you think it through, you think, well, if I help this person, will they help me? Maybe they won't help me, so I won't help them. See, if you have this compassion, it'll happen automatically. And then the Bodhisattva in the Mahayana tradition is required to have this aspect, or is recommended to have this aspect or feeling for all living beings also. So what would it be like if you had this feeling for not only the people that you like, which is not too difficult, but the people that you don't like and the people that you're neutral towards? Maybe that's even more difficult. And then to all insects and to demons and to deities and to ghosts and all those kinds of things. It's a tall order, huh? It's a tall order. But that's the ideal, that's the Bodhisattva ideal, that one goes out automatically to nurture all living beings as if each and every living being were my only child and I have concern for its welfare. So some of the other entities are similar to that. The Tibetan tradition doesn't have the Bodhisattva of compassion becoming a female, it tends to concentrate on two emanations, if you like, of that Bodhisattva called Tara, T-A-R-A, coming from, that's a Sanskrit word which the Tibetans use, coming from the root meaning to cross over, to go across. So the one who leads you across. And it is said that these Bodhisattvas, who are both female, arose from the teardrops of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, or as the Tibetans call him, Jinrizi. So it's still kind of it's still kind of him in some ways, but he drops down two tiers, and one becomes the green Tara. She's very green, and if you get into Tibetan Buddhism, you have to be used to the fact that the high entities don't always look like the kind of people that you would see around. Although, kind of, you know, walking around the mission, maybe, you know, but it's they're different than, and so she has the green of, I would say, eternal summer, that kind of energy. And she is often regarded as more approachable than the Bodhisattva Jinrizi himself, who is sort of rather formally sitting in a cross-legged position. She's always depicted having one foot coming off the lotus. She's almost, but she's already sort of coming off the lotus. And the idea is that she is already coming to you before you've come to her. And persons who have had the initiation into Tara have often found that she's very accessible, much more accessible than Jinrizi. And I found that too, actually. She's always ready to help, and she's extremely nurturing, very compassionate. Then there's the white one. Oh, wow. There we go.
Very
exciting.
Very good.
So then the other form is the white Tara. I don't know whether she's on the other side. who is a little more reserved and is associated more with long life and with health. So anybody who has health problems is recommended to contact White Tara as well as Medicine Buddha, who is a different aspect of the Buddha mind. The big difference, I think, between some of these, between all these entities and some of the entities that we might find in the theistic traditions is that they are, these are not deities who made the world. There's no such entity in Buddhism. They're not responsible for the mess. And so we can't ask them, why did you make things in this way? And also, they're not going to judge us and say, you didn't follow my rules, because they don't have any rules. They didn't put up any rules. So the Buddhas are nurturing without being judgmental. And that comes as a big relief to a lot of people who have been brought up in traditions where they've had a deity who has been primarily judgmental, as they've seen him. This is, I think, especially true in the Pure Land tradition. The Buddha Amita, who is known by a name something like that in the Chinese, the Korean, the Japanese, and the Vietnamese tradition, Buddha Amita is regarded by the Japanese as the parent. He's called Oya-sama, which doesn't translate well into English. It means the honorable parent of either sex. That sounds very cold in English, that the honorable parent doesn't really grab you. In Japanese, I'm told by those who know the language better than I do, the term Oya-sama is really very powerful. It gives a notion of a parent who is really able to help you and is right there for you the whole of the time, and is not a judgmental father, but more like a mother. In the Japanese tradition, I'm told, the father is often kind of removed and judgmental, and it's the mother who picks the child up and helps him or her. Though it's often she also who does a lot of the negotiating, getting you into university and stuff, which is difficult to do over there. So I want to conclude then with a little bit from the wisdom tradition. We've probably all heard of the perfection of wisdom, and we've probably all heard of the Heart Sutra, which should really be called the Sutra on the Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom. Heart Sutra is merely an abbreviation of it. And the perfection of wisdom is often called the mother of all the Buddhas. The idea is that wisdom is the place from which the Dharma arises, and then it goes out into compassion. Wisdom is what knows everything but doesn't do anything, and compassion is what does everything but doesn't know anything. So if we start to help people before we know what we're doing, we're going to mess up. And if we just sit and observe and say, well, I'm afraid you're messing up, that's not helpful to anybody. So the union of the perfection of wisdom, which is said to be the female aspect or motherly aspect, and the compassion aspect, which is the male aspect, it's a little bit different from the way we sometimes put it in the Western tradition, sometimes we reverse those. So one can say in some of the, especially in the Tibetan traditions, what we've done this morning, earlier in the first part of this session, is we just sat. And just sitting can be explained in some Tibetan traditions as focusing on the wisdom aspect of the Buddha mind, allowing the mind to still down, to quieten down, to be still, and to see what is happening, just observe what is happening. And then having contacted that wisdom aspect, hopefully keeping aware of that, going out into the world and doing what we have to do with a compassion aspect. And if we think of the wisdom aspect as a philosophical idea, it's not very interesting. Who would want to bother with it? But, and I think very often Buddhism is represented in the West as a cold philosophy, a cold, unfeeling philosophy. That is a misrepresentation. I got confused about that for some time, and I had to figure out that I was being told the wrong thing. So that's why I also wrote a book to try to reverse all of that. If we wisdom is the mothering, the nurturing thing. So when we sit on the cushion or the chair, we're sitting back into the arms of Mother Wisdom, and she is nurturing us and allowing us to be quiet. We don't have to worry, to be still and be at the breath of Mother Wisdom, and then to go out in the power of that to do what we have to do. I just want to read a short passage from one sutra and then the whole of another sutra, but it's a very short sutra, so don't worry. This is a passage from the 108 names of the Holy Perfection of Wisdom, and it starts off with the verse of adoration. The victorious ones, the jinnas of the past, future, and the present, to them all, you are a lovely mother. This is according to Perfection of Wisdom. The jinnas, the victorious ones, O goddess, that's Perfection of Wisdom talking again, are your sons and daughters, we can say. To have no own being is your own being. So everything, of course, has no inherent existence, and we mustn't think that wisdom is a substantial kind of entity, because nothing is. Of the name of the to have no own being is your own being. Of the names of the lovely mother of the Buddhas, I will now speak. If you want ample merit, listen. And then it starts off with aspirations, with names of wisdom, which are rather abstract. All knowledge, knowledge of the modes, of the path, and etc. But then further down, it has mother of all the Buddhas, genetrix of all the bodhisattvas, support of the entire world, the inexhaustible store of equipment, merit. Whatever that means, there must be a bad translation that I haven't had a chance to check this today in Sanskrit. So it
rather is a store of equipment.
Yes, it says, I don't know what that means. I think it's the sambhara, maybe it is the what you put on when you become a bodhisattva. I think it's a mistranslation, and I haven't had time to go and check the Sanskrit. It says, let me think once again, inexhaustible store of equipment with merit. I think that's the sambhara alankara, which is what the bodhisattva puts on to go out and do stuff. And I think that this is by Edward Conza, who normally knows what he's doing, but I think this time I think he slipped.
You've got 3 minutes.
Yes, okay. I was trying to finish up so you could have time to ask questions. So I just want to finish off this. It all comes back to something very simple. This is the whole sutra here. The blessed perfection of wisdom, the mother of all the Buddhas, or all the Tathagatas, in one letter. So, thus have I heard at one time, the Lord dwelt at Rajagaha on the Vulture Peak, together with a large congregation of monks, with 1,250 monks, they would take a roll call, and with many hundreds of thousands of Nayutas, of Kotis, that's a lot, of Bodhisattvas. At that time, the Lord addressed the Venerable Ananda and said, Ananda, do receive for the sake of the weal of and happiness of all beings this perfection of wisdom in one letter, that namely A, the letter A. Thus spoke the Lord, and the Venerable Ananda, the large congregation of monks, the assembly of the Bodhisattvas, and the whole of the world, with its gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, rejoiced at the teaching of the Lord. So, it's very simple. It's the letter A, which works the same way in English as in Sanskrit, because English and Sanskrit are connected. The letter A is the beginning of the alphabet, and so in a sense it is the mother of all the letters, or of all words, of all language, and therefore of all objects that have a name. But also it acts as it's a negative prefix. We can put the letter A before a word such as amoral and make it into the opposite, so that it doesn't have any inherent existence. It is the affirmation and the negation at the same time. And I think actually it's remarkably similar to what is said about the Aleph in the Zohar, the Jewish tradition. And so that's all it is, the letter A. Just sink back into letter A and you will be nurtured. Thank you. Do we have time for questions, or did I go on too long?
About that storm equipment, I got to study Qigong in China. I crossed the street from a temple to Guanyin, and then the next year I went to her island, Putushan.
Oh, yeah.
But both dreams were about specific practical assistance.
Hmm. Yes.
You know, that you could have confidence that you will have specific needs met.
Yes. Yes.
I just wanted to share that. So the storm equipment, one of them was that, it was a new house. I couldn't believe how everything was there, even a stapler.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah,
that sort of equipment. I see. Oh, yes, yes.
So that's why I think that translation begins.
Yes. Well, there might be something to it then. Certainly, well, I think there is a tendency sometimes, especially when we make any tradition too philosophical, to think of it as rather general. But it seems to me that when we can see the universal in the particular, then we've got something that's extremely genuine. And I happen to be mentioning this to Bob Aitken, the Zen teacher, the Roshi, who is now retired, lives in Hawaii. And I was saying, well, this is about the Pure Land is this way, and maybe Jesus is this way, and so forth. And he says, that's how you solve the koan, when you see the universal in the particular.
At the beginning, I was curious, were you suggesting that the coming of the Buddha was prophesized? Some teachings or writings similarly to Jesus?
Not in the same way as that. When we take a historical critical view of reality, the Buddha just arises that way. But when we look at the Buddhist tradition, the notion is that whenever at long intervals after the Dharma has been forgotten about, a new Buddha will arise. And the Buddha who is to arise is presently living the life of a deity in one of the heavens, which is called the Tushita Devaloka, the realm of the deities who are perfectly satisfied. That sounds great to stay there, but unfortunately, eventually you have to be reborn. So you're not perfectly satisfied the whole of the time. And he can see, because he's in the deity realm, he can see what would be the most favorable time and place for him to be born. And so it's not as much that it's prophesied, but that the entity that has become the Buddha picks the time and place where his teaching will be most effective.
Okay, so Roger, we'll be
okay.
Here.
Yes.
Announcements.
Yes, my name is Steve.
you, and I'm your hostess today. welcome, especially to the new people. Please join us afterwards for tea and refreshments and conversation. If you have tea, please wash your cup. There's a donor bowl to express your generosity and financial support. $5 recommended, more if you can, less if you can. And some of us get together for lunch afterwards.
Yes. Jim and I are looking for a ride back to the East Bay. Afterwards, either after lunch or before.
And the steering committee meeting will be after this session. They start at 20:00. And we want to discuss maybe what we can do with our new meditators who come to our group.
And there's a sign-up sheet. Is anyone here for the first time?
There are a couple of people.
Welcome. There's a sign-up sheet if you want to get on the mailing list with the email.
Let's stand in a circle and hold our hands.
Yes. By the benefits of this practice, may all beings be separated from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings be joined to happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings live in equanimity with those who are near and those who are far. And may all beings find peace, joy, and freedom.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.